Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to this episode of A Time for Justice. A Time for Justice is a legal show on the Elevated Places Network. And on this show, we discuss legal and current events in a round table discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct, which really distracts from the truth, and this is oftentimes the conduct that we see. And we know that truth is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I'm an attorney, and I am the host of this show, A Time for Justice. I would like to thank you all for listening and tuning in to tonight's exciting show. Tonight, we have a very great guest, a very powerful attorney, a good friend of mine, and tonight our topic is lawyering in a criminal justice system and protecting our rights against abuse. When I say our rights, I'm talking about Black people specifically, but of course the poor and the disenfranchised are often abused too. And we're talking about tonight police abuse of authority and these police brutality cases. I'm so excited because I have my friend, Attorney Gerald T. Christmas. Let me read Brother Christmas's short vitae. Gerald Christmas is a veteran litigator with 20 years of experience focusing on criminal defense, personal injury, and civil rights litigation. Mr. Christmas has a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, having served as a parole officer, a municipal prosecutor, and St. Louis prosecutor for 7 years. Mr. Christmas has worked in all areas of the prosecutor's office, including misdemeanors, felonies, grand juries, and sex crimes. Attorney Christmas is an astute politician. He's ran for office to be become the St. Louis City prosecuting attorney. He did run for office, and he's worked on a number of state and local campaigns. This brother has also, Mr. Christmas, has also helped in a United States race where he helped Claire McCaskill get elected, and he actually served as a legislative counsel in Washington, D.C. for 3 years before returning home to St. Louis. Mr. Christmas, who was raised in St. Louis, has deep ties to the community. He served as a local radio host and is often called upon to comment on local and national issues. He's active with the bars, Missouri Bar, National Bar, Mound City Bar. He is a member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, 100 Black Men, and a member of the St. Louis and Central Baptist Church. I'm sorry, Central Baptist Church, which is in St. Louis. Attorney Christmas and his wife have 4 daughters. So again, I would like to thank Attorney Christmas and open up his mic and welcome him to our show. Let's see. Attorney Christmas.
Assalamu alaikum. How are you?
Why, alaikum salam, my brother. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yes, sir. Praises be to Allah. And you know, I'm so excited about you being here tonight, Attorney Christmas. And really, I could call this show an interview with Attorney Gerald T. Christmas because he is our guest tonight, and he has such a wealth of experience. So many things we want to really talk to you about tonight. Now, what it is, Attorney Christmas, I've been wanting to talk about these trials. Since the last time you were on our show, a lot has gone on in the case of police officers being tried for some of the police brutality charges, the excessive force or the assaults or that they were charged with. We've had Amir Locke, who was recently killed as a result of a no-knock warrant. You know, we've had the recent federal convictions in the hate crimes trials with Ahmaud Arbery, and we've also seen, I think, some police officers convicted who were participant in the killing of George Floyd. So, I just think having someone who's very familiar with some of the workings and how these cases work, it was just so important for you to come on. So I really thank you for taking your time to come on. And as another backdrop, I wanted to bring up the fact that here recently, the president, Joe Biden, in his State of the Union address, he did talk about that it's to fund the police. In his State of the Union address this past week, the president declared the answer is not to defund police. It's to fund police. Fund them is what he said. And, you know, that kind of got some eyebrow raising. I know Congresswoman Cori Bush, you know, she was very outspoken as, talking about how people who had lost children, such as Michael Brown Sr., if she was a parent of someone who had lost a child, that she would find that was hurtful because I think the direction was the thought that we were going to see more in the way of reforms and accountability and things of that nature. So, with that backdrop, I want to go ahead and talk to you, Brother Gerald. Any of what I said, if you want to make any comments on any of what I said, just go right ahead.
Sister Pamela, I was disappointed to hear the president make that statement because it's easy to make that statement to support police brutality and the aggression that police have had against our community. It's harder to stand up for those who have been victims. And I really, if you were going to address that issue and you had a problem with the slogan Because people have indicated that they've had a problem with the slogan of defunding the police. Then you can articulate it better and talk about how funds can be reallocated in a better way. Because that's ultimately what people are talking about when they talk about the issue of defunding the police. What they're talking about is the massive amount of money that is being geared toward law enforcement and militarizing the police, as opposed to using that funding for early childhood education, for after-school programs, for mental health counseling, for substance abuse counseling, some of the things that we know that lead to excessive violence in our community. So I'm very much in line with the thought of Cori Bush, Representative Cori Bush from Missouri, because ultimately, as you and I have said before, we have a personal responsibility to make our community safe and decent places to live.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Thank you for that. And I would like to go ahead and announce, if anyone has a question or a comment, please feel free to get into the host queue. So, Attorney Christmas, let's start with just talking to you about yourself as an attorney. And my question to you would be, you know, tell us a bit about yourself and why do you think practicing law, defending those accused of crimes, is so important, especially in the black community?
It's important in the black community, and especially in the St. Louis metropolitan area where I practice, because we have a significant population in our city, in the black community, that is underexposed, undereducated, and underfinanced. And quite often, they do not know what their constitutional rights are. And it's important that we have lawyers in our community, black lawyers, to understand our community and also understand what our rights are. And it's our responsibility to educate our community. And as you grow older, you learn that it's important to walk in your purpose. And I know that it's my God-given purpose to use my legal skills to help my people advance forward. If you call my voicemail, it will say, "Don't say anything, don't sign anything." It's a reason why that's the first thing that comes on when you hear my voicemail, because it's important for people to understand that you have a constitutional right to remain silent. You have a constitutional right to counsel. And many people don't understand that, and they end up, because of their non-understanding of that, getting themselves in more significant trouble. And we have a moral responsibility to educate and work with our people and have patience and love for our people. You know, we have to love and support each other. And we have to use the knowledge that we've been given and the privilege we've been given to help others. So much is given, much is expected. And we have to live up to those expectations. And so I try to do that on a day-to-day basis in my practice, is to take the time to listen to the concerns, to offer good advice, and to do the best that I can to help move us out of this condition of oppression, which we're still in, whether individuals want to believe it or not.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. So then my next question I go to is the motivation to actually practice civil law, where you file civil lawsuits for those victimized as a result of police brutality, police shooting, police murders, in those type of cases. It's my understanding that you do that type of case. Is that correct?
I do. I have a number of wrongful death cases here in the city right now. And you know, the saddest thing about that is that, you know, the clients, I meet them for the first time at the morgue. because a family will call me. They'll tell me about a situation. You know, generally it's been a shooting situation with law enforcement, and now they've lost a loved one. And the first time I meet that loved one is at the morgue or at the autopsy. And you have to, you know, I'm looking at the person trying to figure out, you know, what happened? How did you get here? And how do we unravel how you got here in order to get justification for you, for your loss of life, and also get some relief for your family who's grieving? And I feel so much for those grieving families because it's a tremendous loss. It's a tremendous unexpected loss. And it's at the hands of law enforcement who are shielded. When we talk about qualified immunity and funding the police and the militarization of the police and the actual terrorism that happens in our community by the police and the treatment of our people, and especially our young people. So when they come to you and you know you have the knowledge that you can use to help them, then it's almost impossible for you to say no. Because you know that's your duty and that's your calling. And that's why we do it. Because I'm not the only one. I'm just one here in St. Louis. But, you know, there are many of individual black attorneys like me all across the country that are fighting these battles on a day-to-day basis that people never hear about. Day in and day out. And I commend every one of them because the struggle is real and it's a hard fight. And then when you hear the President of the United States say something like that, you know, that's a slap in our face.
That's right.
For everything that we've been trying to do, we talk about all these cases that people know about. But think about all the cases that we are defending that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
And that number is much larger than the cases that you hear about on a day-to-day basis. And many of your listening audience know that because they know people who have been victims of police violence. They know people who are confined in institutions across this country. I don't know anybody black that doesn't know somebody in the criminal justice system. So that shows you the impact that it has on our community.
No, you're absolutely right. Yes, sir. Very, very interesting. And you know, one of my concerns in wanting to bring this issue to the forefront once again is, you know, you and I have been practicing law since the 90s, and, you know, law is cyclical in terms of how issues are pushed. So we're living in a time now where, you remember the Willie Horton campaign, when there was a real push in the demonization of black males as being the sole cause of any, you know, wrongdoing. You know, we remember the crack cocaine epidemic where they dropped the crack into the communities and then the enforcement and throwing people in jail, at, you know, just at tremendous rates and destroying lives and communities. And so, you know, I'm starting to hear the rhetoric once again, and that's, I think, partly of, you know, some pundits say that's what President Biden was actually praying to the right wing, the Republicans or whoever is just on board with this new push to fund the police because the police and their failure to be held accountable, you know, is still an ongoing problem in the black community. We are targeted, and there is this militarization mindset. So, you know, this is why I think one of the reasons we do have to talk about it, and two things I want to get from this conversation, is that we want to share knowledge, telling people some of the things about how the criminal justice system works, and then we do want to talk about some of the cases that, like you say, that we did see that we do know about. For example, we want to talk about what we saw with Amir Locke. You know, and that has been the latest shooting with the no-knock warrant. And I know, Attorney Christmas, you have had some cases with these no-knock warrants. And so can you tell us about what is a no-knock warrant and what are some of the problems legally when you see that type of mechanism being used to get into people's homes?
Yeah, we're working here in St. Louis to ban no-knock search warrants. Law enforcement have indicated that under normal circumstances, police have to announce themselves before they enter a residence. And as you know, there's no time limit on how much time they have to give before they get ready to announce themselves before they enter. But on these no-knock search warrants, they're able to come into a residence without announcing themselves. And their position is that they need to have these no-knock search warrants in place because the people that they're executing the warrants on could be, one, arming themselves in response to them being at the door, or whatever contraband they think they may have in the house, they could be disposing of it before they enter the residence. And so that's why they feel they have to have these no-knock warrants. But these no-knock warrants are not necessary and they're dangerous. And we've seen the result of that in many circumstances from, you know, Minnesota, Kentucky to St. Louis. The case in particular, Don Clark, that I represent, a 63-year-old man, and they come in on a no-knock search warrant and kill him dead in his bed.
Mm.
And he had no involvement in any drug activity. And so these no-knock search warrants are not necessary for officers to make the arrest that they need, that they think need to be made. No, what really needs to happen is that officers need to do the proper surveillance and have the proper information before they actually are allowed to execute these search warrants. Many times, officers all across the country are executing these search warrants based on boilerplate information. When I say boilerplate, you know, it's just the same language being used from one search warrant to the other. They're not really doing their due diligence in making sure that the houses that they're executing these search warrants are involved in actual illegal activity. They're not following up with the confidential informants. They're not doing their independent surveillance. And it's clear in my case here in St. Louis, if they had done any kind of independent surveillance, they would have known that Don Clark's house would not have been a house for a no-knock search warrant. He was an individual who was a retired Army veteran who was adamant about, he knew drug sales went on his street, but he was adamant about he didn't want any drug sales at his house. He was disabled with a caregiver. If the police had just come to his house, he would have opened the door and let him in. There was no need to do a no-knock search warrant on his house. And then the other thing is that you have these SWAT units, which was used in St. Louis no-knock, executing these search warrants. And you have a lot of police officers on these SWAT units that have served in the military and suffer from PTSD.
Mm.
And they're being assigned to our communities. And that's another issue of concern. So there are several problems across the board with these no-knock search warrants.
Yes, sir. And you know, one of my issues, because the actual ability to go into someone's home, I mean, under the Constitution, people have the right to be, under the Fourth Amendment, you have a right to be safe in your home from unreasonable searches and seizures, and you're supposed to be secure in your persons and your homes. And so the actual execution of a warrant you know, just willy-nilly or on the basis of some kind of boilerplate. You know, it's such an intrusive violation of that right. You know, it's only in the black community have I seen, do we really see that type of freely, executed authority. You know what I'm saying? And it really,
you
some of the research.
Right.
And real quick, the research, it actually goes back to some of the, you know, some of the war on crime that was used and was abused. Our people were abused during this crack cocaine assault when these battering rams, you know, were just invented and, you know, forced into black communities. And oftentimes the people, like you say, wrong house, you know, there's one situation where a woman was sitting with her children and, you know, they just bust into the house with these battering rams. So that practice is really something I think that came from, it's a result of what we saw in the late 80s and 90s. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, it's a result of disrespect for our community and disrespect
right.
for our property and our people. And that's ultimately what it comes from, and that's why it's important for us to educate our people on these issues so they can organize around these issues. And, you know, those are things that we have to do. We have to be able to organize as a community around these issues and address these with our elected officials and call for them to end these practices. Because if we don't organize and be vocal about these issues, then they won't end these practices. And it's extremely important that we do that. You look at the case of Breonna Taylor, where the individual they were looking for was already in custody. So
right.
that tells you how sloppy the police work is. And they have
right.
to be held accountable on these issues. The young man, I can't think of his name right now, it's escaping me, in Minnesota. He was just at that house. The person they were looking for was not even at the residence when they executed this no-knock search warrant.
Amir Locke. Is that Amir
yeah.
Locke?
Right. Yeah. He was not the target of the warrant. The person that was the target of the warrant wasn't even present in the residence.
He had no criminal record.
He had no criminal record, yet he ends up dead. He legally had the right to possess a weapon, yet he ends up dead.
Yeah.
And they wake
yeah.
him up. They bust in the house, waking him up in his sleep. He's not even fully from out under the covers when they kill him. So that shows a lack of compassion for black life. And that's why we say, and people wonder why we have to say Black Lives Matter. That's why we have to say Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And that's why we have to continue to say that Black Lives Matter. Because if we don't say it and continue to say it and push the issue, they, and when I say they, meaning law enforcement and the powers that be in the status quo will not understand. My grandmother used to always say it's the squeaky wheel that gets the oil. And so we have to keep pushing these issues no matter how tired, no matter how repetitive it becomes. We have to continue to keep our foot on the gas. We can never take our foot off.
And it's interesting because we have different ideas on the solutions to some of these problems, but recognizing that there is a problem, because as you well know, me, lots of times I've done divorce law. And so we look at it also from a perspective that when an abuser, which we're talking about, you know, the law enforcement or the government or, you know, white people in general, this system, you know, but when they've abused us for so long and made it very clear that they don't intend to actually give us justice, because we, you know, a lot of times we can even trace all of this back to slavery. You know, there are those of us, of course, with the making our communities decent and safe places to live and actually moving into the mindset of what can we do to build our own community? You know, what can we do to even separate? So, you know, of course, we always talk on this show about the different solutions that are brought to the table. And, you know, this is something that
I might not agree that legislation is ever going to change, because it's now been so long. You know, it's been over, what, 100 years. and it keeps circling back. Because you always share with me, and please share with the audience, as a former person who has worked in public office, we do know that there's a relationship that exists between people who work together. So sometimes these prosecutors work with each other. They work with the judges. They work with the police. If they're of the same race, you know, definitely sometimes they work together. You know, they have a common interest. You know, me personally, I think sometimes that just like in during Reconstruction, when the Klan and the different people, you know, they were in the judge chair, they was in the prosecutor booth. We find them in the jury floor sometimes, and so this mindset about conflicts of interest and collusion is sometimes present, Attorney Jurel. And I know I've heard you address that with just sometimes how if the, for example, if a prosecutor doesn't want an indictment, he may not present the case in such a way to get that indictment. And oftentimes I believe that that's racially charged, racially motivated. So
I don't disagree. There's a significant amount of collusion that happens. You know, I've worked on both sides. I've been a prosecutor, and now I'm a defense attorney. And clearly I know it's much easier to be a prosecutor than a defense attorney. The system is weighted towards the prosecution. Most of your judges are former prosecutors. We look at, you know, we talk about the significance of having a public defender nominated to be on the Supreme Court. We know that in general, to be a Supreme Court nominee, you have to have been generally coming from an Ivy League school, worked in some type of law firm, or had some public office, primarily as a prosecutor, not as a public defender. The prosecutors and the police officers, if you want to give a family set, and I would say police and prosecutors are first cousins. They're not siblings, but they're first cousins. They work very closely together. The system is very heavily weighted towards the prosecution. When you come in as the defense, it definitely is an uphill battle. It was much easier for me to be a prosecutor than a defense attorney. There's no doubt about it. I worked in a prosecutor's office that was predominantly white. Oftentimes, I saw compassion for white defendants I never saw for black defendants. That's one of the things that led me to run for prosecutor, because initially I didn't want to be a prosecutor, because I thought, why would I want to be a prosecutor locking our people up? But after I interned in the prosecutor's office, I learned that the prosecutor's office is, unfortunately, the power side of the criminal justice system, because on the defense side, we react to what the prosecutor does. And it's important, extremely important, to have diversity in the prosecutor's office, because they are deciding who's going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with, and recommending the punishment. And we have to have diversity of thought. There has to be diversity of thought in the prosecutor's office. That's the only way that our people are going to see compassion.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. You're right. Very, very important, because like you said, it brings to mind when we talk about the over-policing and just the targeted assault on our community, where, black youth are stopped disproportionate. That means at a rate much higher than any other race. You know, there's just this whole surveillance, and it's a very much a, what do you call it? I mean, just a real lockdown of policing in the black community. For example, probable cause. What does that look like when it's a black youth driving
versus when it's a white youth driving. You know, very rarely do we hear a white youth being stopped by police and ending up dead. You know, but yet and still, in a New York Times article, they're talking about how the deaths are among a series of avoidable killings across the United States, and how over the past 5 years, police officers have killed more than 400 drivers or passengers who were not wielding a gun or a knife. And, you know, of that number, and that's just me, but, it's, you know, we know that it's been disproportionately black. You know, we've seen the sweeps where they come through the black community and just have people just laid out, you know, handcuffed, stopped and frisked, maybe because they have on a certain khaki pants or, you know, you're on a certain street. And this is, can you talk to us about what probable cause means and how, you know, but what does it mean when it's applied in the black community?
Probable cause in the sense of, you know, when the state charges somebody, they have two ways to determine probable cause, and they have a requirement to show that they had probable cause to charge that person before they're formally charged, which is called the indictment. They can either do that through a preliminary hearing, which is done in open court, where the state brings in their witnesses. They present their witnesses. The defense has the opportunity to cross-examine them, and the judge determines if they have probable cause. Or they can take cases to the grand jury. The grand jury hears the case. The defense is not present for the hearing, and the grand jury votes whether or not there's probable cause. And probable cause is not guilt or innocence, but probable cause is, do we have the right person charged? Is it likely that they could have done it? Because they have to show that they are just not arbitrarily charging people without any evidence. But probable cause is just such a low burden. Is it likely that they could have done it? And then when you add the grand jury, where the defense is not even present, and the grand jury is really just the arm of the prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the prosecutor's office, they use the grand jury for sensitive cases, sometimes, you know, serious cases where they don't, the victims are not quite ready to testify in open court. But they also use the grand jury as a shield if they don't want to do something, or if they want something done that they think may damage them politically, because prosecutors do run for office.
Mm.
So such as the Michael Brown case, when Bob McCullough said, well, I took it to the grand jury, and the grand jury decided not to indict.
Right.
And the general public doesn't know that. They think, well, you know, he did what he was supposed to do. But what they don't understand is the grand jury is the arm of the prosecutor. I was grand jury attorney. You know, we did a cycle in the grand jury when I worked in the prosecutor's office. You know, you started in child support. You went to misdemeanors. You did a rotation in the grand jury. When I did my rotation in the grand jury, if I didn't like the case, the grand jury didn't like the case. You know, the grand jury is just an arm of the prosecution. There's no, when you present a case to the grand jury, there's nobody in there but you and the grand jury. Unlike the preliminary hearing where the defense is present and has a right to cross-examine, that's not available in the grand jury. So it's just the arm of the prosecution. The grand jury does whatever the prosecutor says.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish your thought, please.
I was just going to say on the street, you know, you have some officers that manufacture probable cause. Their probable cause is the fact that you just black. To them, that's probable cause enough. And that's what's problematic with that.
Yeah, because that's excellent. Everything you said was excellent because, like you said, sometimes people are arrested or approached a crime that, because there's a crime that is allegedly seen. And so this is where this ability to say, well, because you're black and you look like you're doing something wrong, then I'm going to approach you, versus this other area where you may have to get a warrant and put some facts down to justify why, you know, this person may have alleged, you know, may have done something. So as you're saying, you know, this, I see you, you're black, you look like you were making a furtive movement, or you look suspicious, or, you know, a number of reasons are sometimes a reason to approach. And once they approach, these, you know, manufactured reasons to approach, anything can end up into including death is sometimes the outcome, as we saw in the Devontae Wright, where we hear this explanation with this officer saying she didn't really think it was a reason to stop, but, you know, it was allowable. It was allowable. It was in the realm of possibility. So they stopped him for some no reason, and, you know, now he's dead. Because
right.
Once that approach is made, either a case could be manufactured, you could get mishandled, perhaps the people have done something wrong. And that's the side we do have to talk about. Of course, we're not condoning criminal activity in any way, shape, or form. The minister talked about that this past couple weekends ago in encouraging us to straighten up our lives and to really, really not do, you know, gross iniquity where you just sin. However, being under assault and being under some type of, you know, just always under surveillance is really nerve-wracking and very abusive. It's like slave patrols.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted to go back real fast. When you talked about going and taking the case to the grand jury and actually handing it to the grand jury, you know, we want to make it clear that our audience understands that there are things that a lawyer can do to increase their burden. And so, therefore, then they can say, well, it wasn't me. I gave them more information and had them figure it out for themselves instead of just making it simpler for them to understand. You know, they create sometimes confusion. I know with Bob McCullough, you know, my thought was that anytime you interviewed all of those witnesses and the possible, you know, his whole mindset is I'm doing this to make sure I get a clear understanding, yeah, but you also are creating a big mess. You're creating an out for perhaps the officer because now he can use some of that, you know, in his defense. And you're also creating a lot of conflict where, as you're telling us, sometimes a prosecutor doesn't have to go to those extremes. They can just make it happen and get an indictment of some sort. Isn't that correct?
It's absolutely correct.
Right, yeah.
It's a probable cause hearing. It's not a hearing where you have to prove guilt or innocence. It's just you're just asking, is it likely that they could have done it? Do we have them properly charged? And is this the right person?
And that,
it's
that
not
would
right
be that.
Thing. And that would be that,
right.
And you could move forward. Bob McCullough could have easily gotten an indictment against Darren Wilson. He didn't want an indictment against Darren Wilson.
Yeah.
And he didn't have the courage to say that, so instead he put it on the grand jury. And prosecutors do that all across the country.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And we've seen that, I think, with some of these trials as well, because there was the Brett Hankinson trial that just occurred, and Brett Hankinson he was found not guilty. He was the officer who was at the scene where Breonna Taylor was murdered or killed in the case where they executed that no-knock warrant at her house. And it was interesting because they chose the system chose the prosecute the grand jury did not indict those officers who were responsible who executed the warrant that the bullets started flying and she was killed. You know, they didn't issue a charge there, but they came back and issued a charge on Brett Hankinson, who was the officer who they said he just was shooting wildly. And it's so sad because he was charged with shooting in somebody else's apartment. So, you know, our sister, Breonna Taylor, who was dead, there's never been any accountability for the police officers issuing that no-knock warrant and you know, entering her house like they did. But in the trial, my point is that even in that trial, there was so much, so many questions that were done that it didn't look like the prosecutor really wanted Hankinson to be convicted as either. And that happens in criminal cases the way they address them, the way they even charge the cases with the defendant could end up in a not guilty. And oftentimes we see this with white, you know, white defendants versus black defendants.
Yeah, it just goes directly to the compassion and the sense of humanity for black life versus white life. And you saw that in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. You saw it in this last case that you just mentioned in Kentucky. You have white people that put more value on white life than they do black life, and they find compassion for that. So, therefore, you had a prosecutor in that case that did not go to the limit that she could have because of the humanity she saw in that officer that she would not have seen in Breonna Taylor. And that's where the problem lies. And how do we solve that?
Yeah, no, that's very real. That is very real. And so then the next point I think, you know, we want our listeners to understand is that there is this law, you know, there's a defense called qualified immunity. And qualified immunity is a legal principle that protects government officials from being charged with any type of wrongdoing, you know, unless it's really, really, unless you can jump through these hoops, right? Can you talk to us about qualified immunity, Attorney Christmas? I have it here. Let me throw out this particular they say qualified immunity is a legal doctrine that shields government officials and law enforcement from civil lawsuits in the event that a citizen's constitutional rights are violated. So we're saying that sometimes your rights can be violated as a citizen by a police officer or a government official, such as a CPS worker, such as a any government official, but you may not be able to sue them because they're shielded by this doctrine of qualified immunity. And we've seen there's an outcry to do away with this particular legal doctrine. But, of course, we haven't seen any success that this government
It's been a real battle. You know, qualified immunity was judicially made to there's no statute. You know, this is a judicial precedent to shield police officers from liability. And that is the problem with it. And, you know, we have a situation going on right here in St. Louis. You know, we elected a progressive mayor in St. Louis who then turned around and appointed a conservative, extremely conservative black woman as city attorney. And she is threatening to appeal a case here that will expand qualified immunity nationwide. And it goes to the corralling of protesters. We had a situation here where protesters were corralled by the police, not only just protesters who were protesting silently, but other people who were just standing around observing that weren't even participating in the protest, on their bicycles, walking their dogs, pushing their children. They just corralled everybody in. They filed a lawsuit. And the court, the initial district court ruled in their favor of the protesters. And the city council's also appealed it to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals here. And the Eighth Circuit came back and ruled in favor of the protesters. And now she is saying she wants to appeal it to the Supreme Court because she feels that the conservative nature of the Supreme Court will overrule the Eighth Circuit, which has implications for the entire nation on the expansion of qualified immunity and how police can treat protesters. And this is coming from a progressive mayor and a black woman that's city councilor, our city attorney. And, you know, we're in a time period now where, you know, having somebody black in a position is not enough. We have to know where your conscience level is. And clearly her conscience level is not where the people are that supported this mayor, Tashaura Jones, to be our mayor of the city of St. Louis. I supported her. But if she's going to keep this woman, Sina Hamilton, as the city councilor, then I'm not going to be able to support her as mayor. Because she said there was going to be a different mandate in the city of St. Louis. And we have to hold these people accountable.
Yeah. Yeah. And just so, you know, to break it down into pieces, St. Louis, as everyone knows with Ferguson, was one of the beginning places where police brutality was just really shown to the world, was unveiled with the killing of Michael Brown and the fact that, you know, St. Louis and the stop and frisk were just very inhumane, holding people into jails and because they can't pay bonds, and 99 municipalities were skipping people around the city. It got the attention of the world with these debtor prisons and just the abuse of black men and women and youth. I mean, people couldn't even walk the streets because of some of these practices. And so I think as you talk about Jason Stockley, who I believe this particular protest was in favor of or was very showing the displeasure of the officer who killed Jason Stock. No, Jason Stockley is the officer, right? So who was the particular person who was killed by this officer, Jason Stockley? And
I knew you were
going
to ask that question. I was trying to think of it because, you know, we had so many cases that they started running together. And I have to think about that because that was a chase situation with Jason Stockley.
Right.
And it's going to come to me in just a minute, but keep talking.
Yeah. And this was the one, I think, where the black male, like you say, he was in the chase, and there was some conversation about whether or not he had a gun and whether or not there was a gun actually that the officer had. It was a very high-profile case. But, you know, again, as we're talking about the need to uproot some of this evil practice with this police brutality and these, you know, holding citizens hostage in their own cities, which really shows that we're not citizens. You know, our constitutional rights are being violated. So as we are moving toward now trying to hold some look at accountability, we're now starting to see that, you know, there's a new tide coming in. Again, we're going back to the president's the union address where he talked about the need to fund the police more. And, you know, now the rhetoric about what needs to happen in black communities, no longer are we talking about the need for the drug treatment or some of the other programs, the jobs. You know, we've gone back to the you know, something that we saw with the Willie Horton, where there's this dog whistle of incarcerating and allowing police brutality to continue to happen, and there's no accountability, going back to slavery. You know, because this is why our show, A Time for Justice, oftentimes we look at, you know, there is no other solution but separation. And this is what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he's told us that it's the only solution. But it's interesting to, we have to let our people know, give them the advantage of our knowledge on how these courts are working and some of what we're seeing in these politics. So I do thank you very much, Attorney Christmas, for that. You know, because
again, we're talking about criminal cases, and we talked about sovereign immunity, and we talked about police brutality. And if anyone wants a question or a comment for Attorney Christmas, because he is an attorney who works in St. Louis, who does fight these cases, he defends people accused of crimes, as well as he files lawsuits in the city against this oppressive and murderous conduct by these police officers shooting our people. So, again, if anybody has a question or a comment, let me go ahead and take this comment or question. Yes, assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam. It's some wonderful information, Brother Christmas, just wonderful information. But, you know, the more you talk, and I have listened to Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the lawyer who coined the phrase critical race theory, and she did a lecture about, racism in the court and how she laid out, think that when these people come into these positions, these official positions, they just leave it all at the door and they're like a newborn baby, but they bring their racism and their bigotry in with them. And she talks about the rulings from the Supreme Court since its inception. Because, I didn't know that like 54 of the first Supreme Court judges were slaveholders. So what kind of rulings are we going to get from them? And that culminating one of the most egregious was the Dred Scott decision. But it feels as if, as black people, we're salmon swimming upstream. With that in mind, that these courts corrupt, racist, bigoted, and we're hoping for them to be better. And it's never going to be better. Not for us, it's not.
I think we have to understand that everybody brings their own experiences to these positions. And like you indicate, nobody's coming like a brand new baby. They're bringing their own experiences to it. But when Sister Pam talks about we need to separate, and when you talk about swimming uphill, we are. But we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors who have consistently worked to get us to this point. And we have to use the resources that we have to take us even further, because we cannot take the position that there's no hope, because there is. And when we think about the past and where we've come from, like when I think about my grandmother and my great-grandmother, if they could see how we live in now, they wouldn't believe it. Because this, how we're living now is something that they only dreamed of. They could have never imagined that we would be living this way. But we have to take this and then take it to the next level. And we have to believe that we can do it. And we have to really work united as a community to move us forward to what's going to be the next level for us. And I do believe that next level for us is going to be separation, and it's going to take us to make that happen.
Yeah. Thank you. I can say that because I have no hope at all in these folks doing better whatsoever.
You're right. That's beautiful, beautiful statement. Because as we talk about, like he say, how they would see us in terms of some of the material or some of the access, and, this world has just become so modernized. But, we've lost so much with our love of community, our humanity, as to how we treat each other. Oftentimes now you see the pictures on the internet about how
young men used to wear suits and ties, or they had a certain sense of cleanliness about themselves, you know, when you know, they just had to look. And, you know, outside the FOI, because, you know, the FOI be representing, of course, people like Attorney Christmas, who is always representing like a you know, a black man in the proper attire, you know, because you want to instill pride in yourself with your cleanliness.
Yeah.
But, you know, with our grandparents seeing the condition of our community today, would they, you know, not be just appalled? Because what we traded out with integration.
Right. And my hope is, and I do have hope, but I have hope in what we can do for ourselves. Because growing up in Mississippi in a small town, very segregated, I have seen what black people can do for themselves. And we've lost a lot of that. So my hope is in that going to do better. It ain't going to do any better. It's going to get worse.
Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you, Sister Marguerite. We appreciate your
yes,
words,
ma'am.
And thank you so much for your comment. You know, because I think the one thing as well, as Attorney Christmas is sharing the knowledge that he has with us, you know, this is interesting because this is what we do for a living, and we do go to these courts every day, and we do participate in some of the defense of our people that we, you know, this is what we do. And so some of the things that you share, Attorney Christmas, I know you often talk about courts and courtroom attire and proper decorum into how people should dress and how they should act when they come into courts, how you should exercise your right to remain silent, because those are things that we can do when dealing with Beastly System. Did you want to make any comments on that?
I just think, you know, all of those things are important about, you know, how you present yourself, that showing it, you know, your sense of hygiene, your sense of worthiness, your sense of respect, your sense of knowledge, all of that makes a difference. You and I both know that. When you come into these courtrooms, especially if you have family support and people in the community that support you, it's important for us as a community to support these individuals that are going to court, because it does make a difference. Because oftentimes the thought is that we don't have any sense of that and that we don't have any support. And it's important that we are organized and together and showing that, you know, we are supportive. We are paying attention to what's going on, and we're watching the decisions that you're making. Many of these judges are up for election, and they need to know that we're watching how you're treating our people, and there will be repercussions if you're not treating our people correctly.
Yeah, we won't. And I think last week we were talking about the protection of juveniles and how when the juvenile is not accompanied by family and support systems, they could be tricked into making false confessions, or, you know, they could be targeted. So, again, it kind of goes into the same situation when we talk about older adults who are coming into courtroom situations, possibly doing things that further incriminate you, you know, what you're saying, how you're saying, you know, like people wouldn't believe that sometimes people come into courtroom situations very, very just screaming and yelling and acting like it's on the playground, or, you know, just really making
really
themselves.
Naive. Just really naive.
Yeah, very. Very naive and with a sense of bravado of like, well, I'm going to be me. But at the same token, there's a way that you conduct yourself in whatever environment that you're in. And so we got to, you know, get back to holding the hands sometimes of our young people you know, and being a part of helping them to really escape some of the traps, because it's all about predatory. It's a predatory system, that's for sure. Wouldn't you agree, Attorney Christmas?
I agree 100%. It's a predatory system, and you need to go in there armed and equipped to deal with it. And, you know, mm-hmm. having support and having proper legal counsel makes a tremendous difference in the outcome. And we see that on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes I see people in court that I wish I could have helped, but, I couldn't because I'm not on the case. But I was in court last week. I think I told you this. It was a gentleman unrepresented. He was there for a preliminary hearing. The state wasn't ready. The judge asked him. He didn't have counsel. The judge asked him, what do you want to do? And the state wanted a continuance. He agreed to that. He asked the judge about an attorney. Of course, the judge couldn't recommend an attorney. He said, you know, give me your email address. I'll send you the list that we have of possible attorneys. He took that list. I stopped him, you know, before he could get out of the courtroom and handed him one of my cards. And I said out loud to him intentionally so the whole courtroom could hear, if the state is not ready, you need to ask for it to be dismissed. Don't ever agree to a continuance. But he didn't know that. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. And many people were sitting there waiting for their case to be called where the state wasn't going to be ready. And I wanted to let them know, if the state is not ready, then ask for your case to be dismissed. Don't agree to a continuance.
Right. Yeah. And that's a really important piece of information. You know, it goes right along with, audience, we heard that. If the state is not ready in a case and they stand up and, you know, they make that announcement, you listen because perhaps your case can be dismissed if you and don't agree to give them more time. You know, it's worth a try. Because, you know, this is the same it's worth a try. Yeah, because this is the same type of activity where people, you know, if you have a fine that you have to pay and you don't have the money on that day to pay the fine, and so rather than not go to court, you know, they threaten you, you know, if you don't come back with the money today, you're going to be in trouble. Well, you know, instead of not going to court, which could get you further in trouble, go and make the plea for time. Sometimes those type of events, you know, people don't know, so they don't feel like they can address the court, you know, respectfully and say, I need more time. Let me see if I can get additional time. Just don't not show up. Sometimes that's not a good idea.
It's never a good idea to not show up. And to have the confidence and be prepared to say, I need more time. And you can also ask the court to lower the fine. You can tell them I don't have the resources to pay this fine, that I have other serious obligations that I have to address. I don't mind taking accountability for it, but I can't take accountability at this amount.
And that's really important. So, again, if anyone has a question or a comment, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. You know, one of the things I kind of pulled out of the St. Louis Post, which is the, you know, that's the newspaper in the city, they talked about the overdose deaths in the city statewide, and they mentioned there that 78% of black people statewide who are dying are from the St. Louis area. And I wanted to put that out there, Attorney Christmas, because, you know, we're protecting our rights, talking about being in the criminal justice system, and drug abuse is one of the issues that we're seeing. And I don't know if there's something that you can advise or that you can inform us of what you're seeing in these courts, because you know, of course, drug rehab and mental health needs are so prevalent today. especially coming out this pandemic with the joblessness and, you know, a lot of confusion.
I agree with you. We have a serious problem with mental health and substance abuse and with this fentanyl. And we really have to address it, and we have to address it in our household. You know, we have some inappropriate behavior that's happening in our communities, and we have to start having conversations to address that, whether we start in small groups or in larger audiences. And it's a sensitive conversation that only we can have with ourselves, but we need to start having these conversations because they're having devastating effects in our community. I lost a very close cousin of my own to a fentanyl overdose a year ago this year. And so I know personally the effect of that. We had a situation just here, Sister Pam, in the senior housing complex on Forest Park in St. Louis, in the Central West End, that's being managed by the St. Louis Housing Authority, where seven individuals died of fentanyl overdose within a 15-minute time period. Where a woman was selling fentanyl-laced drugs right there in the facility. You know, people were actually lining up in the hallway because she was selling it out of her apartment. And, you know, that's another issue with the mayor right now who hasn't addressed that. You know, where seven people died in a matter of 15 minutes. And my initial thought is that if I'm the mayor, and seven people die in a 15-minute time period, and I get notified of that, I'm telling them to pull the car around. We're getting ready to go down there to find out what's going on. Because how can seven people die in apartment complexes being managed under my authority? And we not do anything about it, and we know the woman is now in custody, but she was doing open drug sales straight out of her apartment. How does that happen?
Right.
And again, this is why we talk about making our communities decent and safe places to live and bringing in those people in the community who really do care in the grassroots community, in the faith-based community, you know, individuals, because like as the minister talked about during the Swan Song lecture, he said that you were made to conquer whatever life presents, he proclaimed. And I'm talking about the hopelessness that is somewhat pervading right now. When you look at people coming out of a pandemic, you look at people coming out of this joblessness and just really just bewildered. So he went on to say that with the mind of a conqueror and the spirit of God, anything that came our way in order to get where we are today, we had to conquer. And he says, you are a generation that is born from ancestors that came through the roughest of times, the hardest of trials, the depth of deprivation. Ancestors died longing for a generation that would come forth that would not bend, would not bow, would not scratch when they did not itch, but stand tall. And so, you know, when I hear you saying that, it really talks about a call that in the Black community, we've got some work to do. And we know this, to try to get our people out of that drug addiction. And so I think that's, you know, very important with what you're saying. And we know, we talked about it before, but we know that the law can be used in this way where, you know, there's a lot of empathy that we see being treated with white defendants who are under drug abuse now versus how they were treated under Black when Black people, you know, were cocaine addictions or crack addictions, and there was this lock 'em up mindset, you know, throw away the key. But again, we know this is probably what we can expect from this government when it comes to our community. So it's something that we got to look at, because that is, again, Attorney Gerald, that's something that we talked about. What can we do as a PTU to make our communities decent and safe places to live? And I think that's a very big
big point with what you just brought up.
We have to organize and advocate around these issues for our people, because nobody's going to organize and advocate for us. That's our responsibility to do. Those of us that have the knowledge, those of us that are in leadership positions, it's our duty to do that, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to make a change in this system. That's the only way we're going to be able to save our people. That's the only way that our people are being able to get the help necessary that they need to help overcome these addictions.
Right. You know, and again, as we talk about, like, you know, Sister Marguerite did come on, and when we talk about police brutality, there was a sister in Georgia, and Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, she brings up this story often where a young woman, as a result of one of those murders, either it was Ahmaud Arbery, I think it was Ahmaud Arbery, who was killed in Georgia by those white men, and it was filmed. That prompted her to look at elsewhere to live. That prompted her to look to go off and start a community with some other black people, you know, building, and it hit national news. And so that is definitely a, you know, prompting, because our conversation tonight, we wanted to talk about the beginning stages and, you know, of this dismantling of any kind of even talking points. It looks like they used to just talk about, you know, they were going to do the George Floyd police act, they were going to do all this government was going to do, but now we're back to, oh yeah, just fund the police, and people are getting shot every day. I think there was a young man who got shot in the Bronx today. A young young man who, according to the news report, I don't believe he had any kind of weapon. There was, you know, nothing found. But in these stopping vehicle cases, you know, people are ending up being shot by police, and it's just egregious behavior. It only really happens to black people. You know, so I think, you know, again, we're looking at the brutality and the misconduct. We talked about how the qualified immunity is protecting, you know, as opposed to making them accountable. So, you know, this is where we are. So we're down to the last 10 minutes. Attorney Christmas, if you want to wrap up with any statements, I really, really appreciate you coming on, because, again, you've been in Ferguson as it unfolded, as it went from a Michael Brown to, you know, into a situation where a lot of wrongdoing has been uncovered with the way that city was policed. So did you want to share anything else with us?
I just want to finish with the comments that you made earlier from the minister. We're capable of fighting and enduring any challenge that's presented to us. We have to remember that we are strong, resilient, brilliant people, and we will end up victorious. And we have to believe that and continue to fight for that and continue to fight for our people, continue to fight and challenge this system, and continue to believe in our goodness, in our humanity, in our excellence, and our ability to change this world. And we will do it, and it will happen.
Yes, sir. And our children, because that, you know, we've also, these last months, really been putting a lot of focus on making sure that connection is being made between our young people, our 20-somethings, our, you know, younger, the 16-year-olds, all of the children. And I know as a father of daughters, this is something that, you know, is very much on your heart as well. So, you know, this connection of making sure that the young and just all across the black community, you know, we're looking at what we need to do to move forward in this time. So I really appreciate you. And just end us off with your don't say anything, don't sign anything, and tell us why do you think that's so important that people know that?
Now, I always say don't say anything and don't sign anything. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And it's important that you understand police have the right to lie to you in order to get to what they see as justice. And it's important that you understand your constitutional rights, that you follow them, and that you don't make any statements regardless of the situation. That you don't make any statements, that you seek legal counsel, and that you don't do anything. And I know that sometimes you're scared and you're in these situations where you don't know what's going to happen and you don't know what to say. And you can say to them, I'd be happy to talk to you. All I need you to do is call my attorney first.
That's right.
Because you don't want to get into a confrontational situation. And it's the same, too. Because the school-to-prison pipeline is real, too. And you need to inform your children the same way, because many times, and you know this, Sister Perrin, we represent people, their children at juvenile court, and they're the last ones to be notified because they make these statements to teachers and administrators, and they turn it over to the police, and their children are taken down to juvenile court, and they're already a juvenile court charge based on the statements that they made by the time you find out. So you have to instruct your students, your children, too. And I'm not saying they should be rude to teachers or administrators either, but they need to say, I love to talk to you also, but I just need you to call my parents first. And these parents need to know then they need to call an attorney. Because when the school calls you and says you need to be there because of some criminal situation, they think they need to call law enforcement, you need to call an attorney to meet you at the school, too.
That's right. That's right. We have one. We have one comment or question. Let me open up the mic. Yes, 214. You have a question or a comment?
Yes, this is Brenda Muhammad in Dallas, and I was calling because I could not let this. Walaikum salam. Please forgive me. I shouldn't have been rude like that. Please forgive me, Sister Pamela.
No problem.
I called because I couldn't let this time run out without saying something to my frater, Brother Gerald Christmas. I'm a Zeta, and I'm a Zeta proud of him, and, of course, wishing best wishes and dove love. And I wanted to also make a comment about how I've been very impressed and helped by the information that has been provided tonight, especially the one about appealing.
Praise it to
Lord. You know, sometimes it's you know, asking for extensions and things like that. So just those two thoughts. So thank you for everything.
Oh, thank you. Yes, ma'am, beloved. Mm-hmm. Well,
thank you,
Salam,
Sarah,
ma'am.
Paul, it is. With that,
Come on, now. Come on, Blue Fire. Come on, Blue Fire.
That's what I'm saying.
Waleka Salam. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, and that's a really good point. I think as we end out, what Sister Brenda talked about was appeals, and that is something that I'm really big on is appeals. And also because you should never let a matter that you're not favorable or that you're not willing to accept pass without taking it to the next level, and that is often what we call appeals. And I think the most important thing about appeals is to always remember that you have timelines and time frames. And so you have to do things within a timely manner. Sometimes you might have a one-day window. You may have a three-day window. You may have as long as a 30-day window. But as soon as something happens that you don't agree with, some kind of ruling, some kind of opinion, make sure you talk to someone immediately to see how much, if any, time you may have to take that to the next level, the next court. Wouldn't you agree, Attorney Christmas, that's very important that we remember, because you may have a great right. You know, there may have been a mistake made in your case, an egregious harm done, but if you run out of time, you won't be able to raise it. And this is why a lot of people are in jail unjustly. You know, for things they didn't do because they may have ran out of time. And at least it's your right to exercise your right. So I think that was the excellent point she brought up. Thank you, sister.
I agree 100%. You have to jump on that immediately.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So yeah, well, again, we are thankful for this conversation. We wanted to kind of clear up some of the thoughts on police brutality, the misconduct, what they talk about with qualified immunity. I think it shows that we live in this is an unjust system, and if police officers know that they're not accountable and protected sometimes because of this doctrine of qualified immunity, this is also supporting why we see a lot of the activity on the streets when it comes to police brutality. And so, we really are wanting to look at making our communities decent and safe places to live, and talking with today's youth, and being a part of mentoring and being a part of working with our young people who may need help. So those are some of the things we want to talk about tonight. And I just want to say thank you for listening to the Elevated Places Network Presents the Time for Justice. To hear our previous shows, you can log on to the Elevated Places Network. I want to give Attorney Christmas a chance to tell us how he can be contacted. Attorney Christmas, give us your information, please.
You can reach me at 314-588-7105, 314-588-7105. And, I always am grateful that you allow me to come on your show, and I really appreciate it, and I thank you for that.
Yes, sir. And look, last minute, we have one more caller, so this is really awesome. Let me open up the mic for this particular caller. This caller, 31, your mic is open. Did you want to make a comment?
I sure did. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Dr. Pamela.
Wow, Lake of Salam, Sister Ula, thank you so much for calling. So we're down to
thank
a couple
you.
Of minutes, Sister Ula. You have a
yes,
comment?
Ma'am.
Yes,
I
ma'am.
Do, my dear sister. When I listened to the attorney and he spoke on mental illness, I reflected on two of my goddaughters. I had 27 of them who attempted to commit suicide, and I stayed with one of them for 30 days. Until she came out of that depression. And we were taught in social work class that you should always look for signs of suicide, like they changing patterns, et cetera. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and with my prayers that we can do all we can to help our people. Thank you, Dr. Mr. Pamela from Lakers.
Well, Lake of Salam, and thank you so much for that, Sister Ula. Thank you for your comment. And I think also, as we talked earlier, I also want to put in there that our brother Ishmael, Minister Ishmael, he has really done some really wonderful lectures pointing to people getting help who may have, some despair thoughts. Sister Ava, she did a wonderful, wonderful workshop that is still accessible on that topic as well, of how people can get help when they're feeling depressed and despair in this time. That came from Attorney Gerald was talking about the drug use. We also had Brother Nuri, who actually has been talking, and he's available to help as well. And so those are some people in the Muslim community. But we do encourage everyone to seek refuge in seek out help. So thank you so much for that, Sister Ula. And as I was saying, I want to thank Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad and the Elevated Places team, Sister Rona, Sister Donna. I'd like to thank Sister Samaya, who is the producer of this show. And I would really like to thank the listeners and callers so very much for calling in to tonight's show. We really appreciate you listening, and we love your comments and your questions. So please call back again next week for the Elevated Places Network Presents A Time for Justice. Thank you once again for listening. Assalamu alaikum.